From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Hello and welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Kim Lewis, and joining me on the panel this week are VOA congressional correspondent Katherine Gibson and Christian Science Monitor Washington Bureau Chief Linda Feldman. Welcome, Linda and Katherine. Well, here are the issues. Israel's parliament passed a law to restrict judicial power in a move that critics say threatens democracy. Tens of thousands of Israelis have blocked roads and say they will continue to protest. Britain's defense ministry says that Russia has altered its naval activity in the Black Sea, adding that there is a possibility Russian forces were preparing to enforce a blockade of Ukraine. Here in the U.S., President Biden's son, Hunter Biden's plea deal involving tax and gun charges was put on hold in a sudden twist that saw the judge presiding over the case questioning the parameters of the agreement reached with the Justice Department. House Republicans met for a final time ahead of their August recess amid high tensions over the question of presidential impeachment. They are weighing whether they should act to expunge the impeachment of former President Donald Trump while exploring the possibility of impeaching President Biden over unproven claims of financial misconduct. A former U.S. combat officer says the U.S. government absolutely has recovered extraterrestrial craft. The former member of a Department of Defense task force made the claim in response to a House member's questions during a congressional hearing on Wednesday. President Biden signed a proclamation designating a national monument to honor Emmett Till, an African-American 14-year-old who was abducted, tortured, and murdered in 1955 after being accused of making inappropriate advances toward a white female grocery clerk. The national monument will also honor Till's mother, Mamie Till Mobley, who was instrumental in keeping the story of Till's murder alive and whose fierce advocacy was a catalyst for the civil rights movement. Well, those are the issues, and let's get started. Well, in Israel, thousands of people continue to protest against plans by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government to overhaul the judicial system in Jerusalem. For protesters, they say these plans will be a disaster for Jerusalem and a historic change for the entire country. So, Linda, why are these plans causing such a divide?
The law that was passed on Monday is a profound change in how government operates in Israel. I actually learned that Israel does not have a written constitution, unlike the United States. Its governance is really almost by custom. I know they have basic rules of law and ways of operating, but essentially what's happened is that the Israeli Supreme Court now only has limited ability to strike down government actions. And what this has done is inflamed the long building divide in the country between the right wing and the left wing. The rift is deep and has been going on for months. Just over the judicial overhaul, there's now an alarming side effect where you have thousands of Israeli army reservists who are threatening not to show up for work. I've been to Israel, it's been a while, but it's a very, very small country surrounded in a sea of some hostility, shall we say. And Israel could lose some of its readiness for war if it came to that.
That's an important point that Linda brings up about Israel's lack of a constitution and that it's governed more on custom than any standardized set of checks and balances. President Herzog was here in the U.S. recently and spoke to Congress a little bit, touched on this issue before that law was passed, but when that was anticipated, and said, look, the protests in the streets are a sign of Israeli democracy at work, that we are a country that welcomes an open and healthy debate. But when we really get down to it, they don't have the same system of checks and balances that we have here in the United States, where the judicial branch is a co-equal branch of government to the executive and the legislative. And the cracks in that system are really starting to show now in the sense that, you know, the executive can indeed be in charge of the judicial branch in Israel. And of course, I think you can't underestimate, as Linda mentioned, the importance of those reservists going on strike. This is another sign that this is not going to be calming down anytime soon.
Yes, those are some really good points that you all have raised. So where does Washington stand now regarding relations with Israel?
That was a tricky address to Congress because we had some progressive Democrats before the speech making claims about Israel being racist. They, of course, walked back some of those claims. Some of the members of Congress did, at least. And there was an uneasiness among some that if the U.S.-Israel relationship is changing, and the president had even addressed that in his speech. He mentioned that there's now a newer, younger generation of politicians coming up here in the U.S., who don't quite have those bonds that some of the older generation of politicians have, you know, that memory of World War II, that memory of the founding of the State of Israel. We're very much in it, moving into a new generation that is questioning some of the actions by the Israeli state. And he made it very clear. He said any questioning of the State of Israel, of its very existence, is anti-Semitism and cannot be tolerated. He said that criticism can be tolerated, but not questioning the existence of the State of Israel itself. And I think you're starting to hear more and more voices in the U.S. Congress that are expressing concern, particularly, of course, with this lack of checks and balances in their system.
And retired Israeli Navy soldier Danny Lancer said he sees Netanyahu's determination to pass the bill as, quote, one person drowning in accusations and under trial who decided to change the face of the nation in order for him to eliminate the trial and not take any responsibility for the consequences of his own actions, unquote. So is there any validity to that?
To me, just looking at the world at large, you see these leaders who've been in office a very long time. And I think for everybody, for all leaders, frankly, much beyond 8 years, they're past their sell-by date. I think they lose perspective. Bibi Netanyahu, for example, is still in legal trouble. He's on trial for corruption, and that's not a good look. You know, people are concerned that with this reduction in judicial authority, that the country could be on a path to autocracy or even a theocracy of some kind, which certainly doesn't help in this country where you do have, as Catherine noted, you have this segment of Congress that isn't sympathetic to Israel, sees them as racist. Nobody sees a two-state solution coming anytime soon for a Palestinian state alongside Israel. So it all seems to be bogged down in a way that's just not good for a country whose founding and whose existence is really, in some ways, fundamental to this country. It stands for a recognition of rights, the never again message about the Holocaust and about people's ability to live freely and thrive. You know, Israel has had a thriving tech sector, very entrepreneurial, sell products all over the world. With this massive change in Israeli governance, there's concern that that can't continue to thrive.
Britain's defense ministry says that Russia has altered its naval activity in the Black Sea, adding that there is a possibility Russian forces were preparing to enforce a blockade of Ukraine. Last week, we discussed Russia's pulling out of the Black Sea grain deal and its ramifications for the rest of the world. Now, what are Russian President Vladimir Putin's, what are his objectives now?
Well, he's working mightily to prevent the Ukrainian counteroffensive from making much headway, and it really hasn't. It's been going on for a couple of months. Last fall, it took 4 weeks for Ukraine to liberate more than 4,500 square miles of territory outside Kharkiv. And then further south, a simultaneous campaign took 2.5 months to free the city of Kherson, which was the only regional capital that Ukraine had captured in the war. Since June, since Ukraine has been fighting in this big counteroffensive, they've only retaken about 100 square miles so far. So this thing is really stuck in a stalemate. Some Americans, you know, military people are thinking that we might have to go toward a more defensive posture. I mean, we're running out of ammunition. We're sending them cluster weapons because we had nothing else to give. And American tolerance for this war and for our billions and billions and billions of dollars that we're sending over there is limited. So it might be that while the Ukrainians are determined to retake every inch of their country, including Crimea, it's not clear that the American people as a whole are willing to just keep funding it to the max the way we have been.
That's right, because that's exactly what's been at issue the past 2 weeks in the U.S. Congress. First, we had the debate in the U.S. House of Representatives, where some of the more right-wing conservative members tried to get real blocks instituted on that aid. They want a dedicated inspector general of the U.S. overseeing how that aid is distributed. That was defeated in the U.S. House of Representatives. And we actually had a debate late Wednesday night about that in the Senate, where they are also debating the annual massive defense spending bill. Those amendments were defeated pretty widely. But there's also going to be a debate about the larger issue of Ukraine aid, how much money the U.S. should be sending when there are so many economic concerns at home. And Mitch McConnell, the Senate minority leader, the Republican leader in the U.S. Senate, has really been a strong proponent of making sure that that aid continues to flow to Ukraine. And I know many of our listeners will probably be aware that he had a pretty serious health incident this week where he appeared to be having some sort of possibly stroke or other mental incident where he was unable to speak for a prolonged period of time and had to be led away by other members of his party. He was eventually brought back, of course, but he has really been helpful in bringing together Republicans and marshaling that support among Republicans to keep that aid going. So we're at a very, very delicate time in terms of U.S. funding for aid to Ukraine. And we just don't really have a lot of information about that new counteroffensive and how well it's going. So it'll be very interesting to see how that plays out on Capitol Hill over the next few days.
Very interesting. And it's time now for a quick break. And when we return, we'll look at the latest developments in U.S. politics. Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/issues. Now back to our panel via Skype, VOA Congressional Correspondent Catherine Gibson and Christian Science Monitor Washington Bureau Chief Linda Feldman. Well, Hunter Biden's plea deal involving tax and gun charges was put on hold in a sudden twist that saw the judge presiding over the case questioning the parameters of the agreement reached with the Justice Department. So what does this mean for the president's son and his case?
This is actually an issue that initially came up in some of the House hearings about Hunter Biden. There was concern among congressional Republicans that if this plea deal was made, it would provide him immunity from other potential charges, which, of course, congressional Republicans are interested in pursuing. And they had to take a break and kind of hash out whether or not that was the case. He did indeed come back and end up entering that plea deal. But that is a deep concern for congressional Republicans on the Hill who say that this issue of his business dealings overseas, what they allege is his father, the president's possible involvement in those business dealings. They say that this issue is far from over in terms of their sense of what they need to be investigating.
Right. And I think it's important to note that this broad immunity from prosecution, which was part of the deal that's now on hold, it's important to know that this is only referring to things that have already been under investigation. I mean, it sounds like he was being given a get out of jail free card for like the rest of his life. I wasn't in the courtroom. I had to write about it, and I was following it very closely as we get the live updates from the New York Times and the Washington Post. It just sounded crazy. This never happens. Usually when there's a plea deal reached between the prosecution and the defendant, the judge just signs off. But this judge, I think, did her due diligence and said, wait a minute, what's going on here? Even last week, it was clear that there was a disconnect here between the prosecution and Hunter Biden's team. Because the prosecution was saying that the investigation was ongoing and the Biden team was saying it wasn't. So in a way, we shouldn't be too shocked that it fell apart. And I think they will come to some kind of accommodation. But certainly the politics of this are only going to grow. This really does go right into Joe Biden and his reelection campaign, because there are people saying they do have evidence that Joe Biden not only discussed his son's business dealings, which they've denied until recently, the White House has been denying that that's not the case, and now they have conveniently dropped that line, but also that Joe Biden himself personally profited financially from the deals. That is very much still under investigation. None of the allegations are proven, but it doesn't mean that Donald Trump and other Republicans running for president aren't going to keep pressing this and perhaps trying to plant seeds of doubt in the public mind just about Joe Biden's honesty and integrity.
Right. And I think there's a sense up on Capitol Hill that this is a very delicate balancing act for congressional Republicans to strike going into a presidential and congressional elections year. There are some congressional Republicans who have said, look, when I go back home to my district and talk to my constituents, nobody talks about Hunter Biden. Hunter Biden is a DC issue that some congressional Republicans want to keep this focus and spotlight on. There's, you know, a little bit of conflict within the party about how far they should be pursuing this issue. This is, as Linda mentioned, something that former President Trump has brought up quite often. So it is clearly an issue that he wants to press. But I don't know that the entire Republican Party is behind him on that.
Yes, and this brings up the other issue that the House has been discussing, and that is, number one, whether they should act to expunge the impeachment of former President Trump, and also exploring the possibility of impeaching President Biden over these unproven claims of financial misconduct. So on first looking at the expunging of President Trump's impeachments, is House Speaker Kevin McCarthy looking to do this?
I think my sense among lawmakers up on Capitol Hill is that when you start expunging things that were done in the past in previous congressional sessions, you're really going down a slippery slope. And I don't think there's a huge amount of appetite for doing that, even among Republicans. This is something that a handful are interested in doing. But the sense is that really is not a good use of their time when they could be doing other things. I think that is something that McCarthy is going to have to keep a close eye on. Now, what is more interesting is, as you mentioned, this possible impeachment of President Biden, which there seems to be a lot more appetite for. There have been multiple hearings about his immigration policy. There's been a sense for months that his Homeland Security Secretary Mayorkas may be impeached as well. That could be one of the elements that he could be impeached on. Of course, we have to take a step back and look at the basic numbers of this. House Republicans do technically have the numbers if all of their party goes for it to pass that impeachment. But then when we move over to the U.S. Senate, the Democratic-controlled U.S. Senate is never going to vote to find Biden guilty of those charges. So it is a little bit of a non-starter, and there's going to be a political question. Is this really, again, what Republicans should be making their signature issue headed into an election year? And they're about to spend time in their home districts. They have about a 6-week break coming up for the summer. They're, believe me, going to be taking the temperature with their voters to see how much of an appetite there is for this kind of thing.
Well, the House of Representatives Committee, they held an eagerly awaited hearing on UFOs. What came out of this hearing?
Yeah, I covered this hearing, and this was, to be honest, fascinating to see, just simply from the perspective that you rarely get so many revelations out of a House committee hearing. You rarely see so much bipartisan interest and bipartisan expressions of cooperation to really improve government transparency. There was a sense in this hearing that the U.S. government has truly obscured some very important information from the American public. And among that information is the witnesses telling us that they saw unidentified objects of a level of technology and ability that we simply do not have on this planet. And that these witnesses told lawmakers that they believed that they were extraterrestrial. They also made some pretty startling claims that the U.S. has had alien pilots, that people have been injured by these objects, that they are posing a national security threat to our military and also to our commercial aviation. That was a really interesting revelation to me, that these witnesses saying, you know, look, it is starting to become an issue that these objects will be flying into our commercial flights. And Congress really needs to get together and remove the stigma from reporting these incidents and make it clear that people should not face retaliation for reporting them, and that that will help really address this issue. Looking at it from a broader sense, if this is indeed true, that this is the ramifications of it are pretty incredible. It was a fascinating hearing.
All I can say is that my grandfather, who was an astrophysicist and worked on the original moonshot, he did not believe in UFOs. There is no evidence, though he's been gone a couple of decades. I will note that the person who testified said the U.S. has likely been aware of non-human activity since the 1930s. I guess call me a skeptic, but you know, I want really rock solid evidence that these UFOs or unidentified aerial phenomena aren't just some foreign country messing with us, or I don't know.
That is ultimately the problem with hearings like this, is that there were certain elements of lawmaker questioning of these witnesses where the witnesses had to simply respond, that's classified, I can't answer that. They were denied access to go into a classified briefing area, so they couldn't get into those issues. And really, again, we haven't seen any declassified documents that provide rock solid proof of the claims these witnesses made. So while there were very interesting revelations, we're still at a point where I don't think this hearing moved the needle significantly in terms of convincing people this is indeed real.
Well, in looking at our last topic, President Biden signed a proclamation designating a national monument to honor Emmett Till. The national monument will also honor Till's mother, Mamie Till Mobley. Honoring his mother as well is really good because she was very instrumental in keeping the story of Till's murder alive, and her fierce advocacy was a catalyst for the civil rights movement.
I think you brought up a good point, Kim, that not only is this incredibly meaningful to honor Emmett Till, but honoring his mother. I believe she was the one who insisted on an open coffin. Those incredibly soul-shaking images were instrumental in fueling the civil rights movement here in this country. So I was very glad to see her included in that. That was a particularly meaningful moment this week.
I would urge anybody who visits Washington and goes to the African American History Museum to go to the Emmett Till exhibit. I've been to this museum 3 times. To me, that exhibit is the heart and soul of the entire building. It is absolutely gut-wrenching. I mean, bring tissues. The casket is there, or was there when I visited. Mamie Till Mobley is no longer alive, but they have a video recording of an interview with her when she talks about her decision to display her dead son's mutilated body. That woman had such incredible courage. I'm just choking up talking about it right now. I'm just thrilled that these memorials are in the works.
Till's cousin, the Reverend Wheeler Parker Jr., said at a White House ceremony this week, he says, it has been quite a journey for me from the darkness to the light. So I thought that was very, very profound. And of course, this ceremony was attended by dozens of people, including other family members, members of Congress, and civil rights leaders. Well, it's time now to find out what is weighing on the minds of our panelists this week. Linda, what is weighing on your mind this week?
Oh my gosh. I mean, with all the heavy news, I tend toward something fun and entertaining. And there's actually been a lot. I love sports, so I'm loving watching Lionel Messi jazz up Inter Miami soccer. I mean, suddenly soccer is big news in this country, especially after World Cup. So that was fun. The real thing I wanted to talk about is the Barbie movie, which I think will play internationally. I went on opening weekend. I like Greta Gerwig, the director, and the movie is fun. I didn't love it, but I did laugh. And bottom line, as the mom of a daughter who's now an adult and who was given Barbies, this whole idea that Barbie sort of objectifies women and turns them into just objects, I think people can play with Barbie dolls and not be psychologically damaged. I think there's no problem with Barbie.
Yes, I played with Barbies until I was 12 years old. I had every kind of Barbie you can imagine. I had it.
Same here. I can say that too. And I completely agree with Linda. I was never psychologically harmed by playing with Barbies. Really, that opened up my imagination. So it was a very good part of my childhood.
It was fun. It did open up your imagination. And she had countless clothing. The wardrobes were just amazing.
Countless pieces of clothing and countless adventures. So it was a good thing. I'm going to be a little bit more serious with my Can't Let It Go, just simply because we are in a very busy time up on Capitol Hill, where we are trying to finish the National Defense Authorization. We're rushing through all of these huge issues for the United States. And it strikes me every year, as it did this year, that the U.S. Congress always leaves the bulk of its work for the absolute last minute. So I just want to say to any of our listeners out there, if you are ever worried about procrastinating or not getting enough work done quickly, just remember the U.S. Congress does it every year and they still somehow manage to get things done.
Thank you. And thank you both for your thoughts. And we'll end the show on those notes. My thanks go to our panelists, VOA Congressional Correspondent Catherine Gibson and Christian Science Monitor Washington Bureau Chief Linda Feldman. I'm Kim Lewis, and be sure to join me next weekend for more Issues in the News.